great to be around the world, and thank you for your company once again on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter u.org. Joining me is Ken Lane of okihebrew.com and the contributor to the book Levush Malkut, or Royal Attire, by Hacham Mordechai Ben Nissan, vocalized, translated, and annotated by Gabriel Wasserman, and available through thekaraitepress.com. Welcome back, Toma Mangubi.
Hi there.
G'day, guys.
How you doing?
Very well, thank you, my friends, and thank you for joining us once again. I want to jump off the book, Royal Attire, once again, if I may, page 41, and I'm just going to read this. This is chapter 5. It says, in Exodus chapter 16, the commandment of Shabbat, it is written, and then again in chapter 20, in the Decalogue, a third time in chapter 23, and a fourth time in chapter 31, and a fifth time in chapter 35, where it says, ye shall cause no fire to burn throughout your habitations on the Sabbath day. That, of course, is Exodus chapter 35, verse 3. Now, there's a note there. And this note says on page 41 of Royal Attire, this verse has been translated in accordance with the traditional Karaite interpretation, which deems the verse to forbid causing a fire to burn on the Sabbath, even if the fire was lit prior to the Sabbath. Rabbinic halakha forbids kindling on the Sabbath itself, and therefore permits keeping a lit flame, such as that of a candle or an oven, on the Sabbath, if the flame was lit before Shabbat. The meaning of this verse was the source of many polemics between Karaites and Rabbinites. Now, if I was writing that note, I would have put many in capitals, I think, and maybe put it in bold as well, because that's almost an understatement when it says many. I mean, it was incredible. Ken, as the as one who is often referred to as the Karadox paradox, I want to ask you a question. Actually, before I even ask the question, can you tell everybody what that means?
I'd say the Karadox persuasion is someone who embraces both rabbinic halacha as well as Karaite halacha. But usually we've been trying to live between the worlds while embracing both and respecting both as well. But I will say that most people who are quote-unquote Karadox, nobody like officially has that on a name tag somewhere, but the people that would say, I don't necessarily recognize Torah Shebaal Peh as being from Har Sinai, that it's developed just the same way that Karaites say that their halakha was developed by sages through study of Tanakh and other sources like that. But yeah, we would be coming down somewhere in the middle, and it does sometimes sound like picking and choosing, but it is based on an actual scriptural interpretation of whatever it is that we happen to be looking for.
With that in mind, Ken, let me ask you, Shabbat candles, do you?
Oh, Shabbat candles are not something that is observed by someone who has respect for the Kari Halacha. Mm-hmm. We do have a middle ground, though. Because actually, personally, in my house, we use an LED candle, which is battery powered, and we don't start any fires and let them linger through into Shabbat. But it is kind of also in respect with, I think it's in Shabbat 23 Beit, where the Rambam considers Ner Shabbat, which would be like Shabbat light, principally for the sake of enjoying the Sabbath and to be able to bring about that ambiance. Now, I know a lot of Karaites would say that the ambiance is something that is rabbinically created, that back in times when Karaites would traditionally, when no other light was possible, that was kind of when people would go to sleep, because you can get your solid 8 hours whenever the sun goes down. There's not much to do. I mean, they didn't have many other forms of enjoyment, except for, you know, the rabbinic scholar might be studying a book by candlelight, but since then it's been going to sleep. But something other interesting too, I was in prep for this episode, I was looking into what Rashi would have to say about this verse. Mm-hmm. And what was really, really interesting was the interpretation whenever this is brought up. I'll just read the Rashi here. It says, this prohibition is indicative on the Jewish principle that the Torah can be understood only as it is interpreted by the oral law, which God taught to Moshe, which he transmitted to the nation. The oral law makes clear that only the creation of fire and such use of it as cooking and baking are forbidden, but there is no prohibition against enjoying its light and heat. And then he goes on to say, deviant sects that denied the teaching of the sages misinterpreted this passage to refer to all uses of fire, so that they would sit in the dark throughout the Sabbath, just as they sat in spiritual darkness all their lives.
All their lives.
So they had something really rough to say about it. And while I don't agree with that really much at all, I do see why they would say, oh, this is something that you do in order to call the Shabbat a delight, which is also in Tanakh as well.
Right. Now, Tomer, as one who sits in spiritual darkness all his life, it says now, of course, in the Stones edition, I've just got it in front of me here, the Art Scroll, you shall not kindle fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day. And just going back to royal attire, and Chacham Mordechai ben Nissan quotes it as, ye shall cause no fire to burn throughout your habitations on the Sabbath day. The note, as I read, saying this verse has been translated in accordance with traditional Karaite interpretation. Break it down for us, Tomer. What is the difference between those two translations?
Sure, definitely. So the translation where you translate it as burning fire or as lighting a fire, which is the rabbinic translation, is one that prohibits starting a new fire on Shabbat or feeding a fire. But the Karaite translation is basically in the more or less in the passive voice. It says you should have no fire burning on Shabbat. And that means that even if the fire was lit before Shabbat, you should turn it off before Shabbat so that it doesn't burn on Shabbat.
Is there room for both interpretations as you understand it? I mean, textually, is there room to interpret legitimately one way and the other?
Yeah, as I personally understand it, I'd say yes. You know, the verb used for burn here, it's not clear whether it's in the passive voice or whether it's in the active voice. The tense that's used isn't the tense for like the regular passive, but that doesn't mean that it's not passive. There's a lot of sort of fluidity between the tenses. So yeah, I think from the verse on its own, that one verse, you could read it either way. And something that many people who have cursory knowledge of Karaites will say, look, we know that they don't have fire on Shabbat, but there's actually more to it than the reading of this one verse. It's part of a larger system that this prohibition fits on it, why the Karaites forbade it on Shabbat and rabbinic Jews permitted it.
When you say it's part of a larger system, are you referring to peripheral verses that may pertain to this verse?
I would actually consider this verse to be the peripheral verse because it's about one special case of work or melacha, which is fire. And the main verses that set up the general prohibition elsewhere are where the sages derive that fire and a lot of other acts that are kind of left running over Shabbat should be forbidden.
Give us one of those verses, Tomer.
Yeah, definitely. So if you read the verse right before the one you just read on fire... Says, I don't know if you want to read that one.
Yeah, I'll read it to you. I've got it here. These are the things that Hashem commanded to do them. Verse 2, on 6 days work may be done, but the 7th day shall be holy to you, a day of complete rest for Hashem. Whoever does work on it shall be put to death. You shall have no, you shall not kindle a fire, or you shall have no fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day. Tomer.
Okay, so let me tell you, it's the verse immediately before the one prohibiting fire. And can you see why that verse would be read to mean no fire should be left burning on Shabbat?
No, I don't see the connection specifically. I can see how maybe the context of doing no work can then, one might argue, and I have heard the argument of people questioning, well, is this specific to work-related fire? And indeed, much of the professions and much work that had to be done, certainly in the day, revolved around the use of fire as a tool. Is it specific to work-related fire? But I have a feeling you're going somewhere else.
I am going somewhere else, although that's not a bad argument. What the sages said, basically, they took a careful look at the tense. 6 days, shall work be done, as opposed to shall you do work? And they took that to mean that no work kind of should be left running on Shabbat, or should be left operating or happening on Shabbat, even if you're not the one actively doing it.
Now, that still, though, lends itself to the possibility that we're talking about work-related fire, if the fire is to be taken in its full context. Now, speaking of the context, the structure of this passage suggests that it is altogether. There's no breaks in the passage here, as there is after verse 3. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think it's all one passage. And, you know, now we're getting into something else, which is, what do we mean by work? And so I've translated right now the Hebrew word melacha as work, but a more accurate translation might be task. And the way the sages define it, the Karaite sages define it, is anything that would accomplish a goal. And since fire, whenever it's used, it accomplishes some goal, even if it's not employment, they'd see leaving a fire running, as whether it's for heat or for light, as being prohibited under normal circumstances.
Ken?
I was looking at other Karaite sources for the interpretation of fire and melacha on Shabbat. And one that I did find was actually your translation, Tomer, from Mikdash Me'at, when Rav Eliyahu Bashiatzi, he said that he disagrees with most Karaite scholars and allows for a previously burning fire to keep burning on Shabbat. I know that he disagrees with Karaite sages on a lot of different grounds. Well, not a lot of different grounds, but he has his opinions. Could you expound on possibly why Bashiatzi disagrees, even though he usually follows the Karaite train of thought?
Yeah, definitely. I think at the bottom line, you know, behind any law, there's a level of pragmatism, and I think that was probably driving a lot of his philosophy. And he goes on for several reasons. He brings several arguments, and because this was such a prolonged debate between Karaites and Rabbanites, there are many arguments on either side, and each needs to be addressed in turn. But the gist of what Bashiatzi argues is that whereas other work that's left to be done on Shabbat over the course of Shabbat is forbidden, there's kind of an exception for things which are natural work. And he says that fire is an instance of something natural. So like just like you can plant seeds before Shabbat and let the trees grow on Shabbat, so too you can light a fire and let it burn on Shabbat.
Okay, would we put this into the category of a rational approach, Tomer?
You mean specifically the natural, the natural versus unnatural?
A pragmatic approach to fire on Shabbat. Would we equate that to a rational approach, as I've often heard the term being spoken of in conjunction with a Karaite interpretation?
Yeah, I definitely consider it part of the rational type philosophy. And really, the Karaite sages said something else, which is that the mitzvot were only given according to our ability to do them, which means that they view the mitzvot as always being something that you can achieve, generally speaking, in everyday life. So from that standpoint, Bashiatzi's pragmatism is very Karaite, although his reading of this particular verse is definitely breaking with most of Karaite tradition up to that point.
Right.
But I actually want to, there's two things I want to clarify. One is moving back a little, right? I had mentioned that because this verse is in the passive tense, the sages concluded that even work that you leave running shouldn't be allowed on Shabbat. So their classic example is kind of if you open a dam and let the water run to water your field on Friday night or Friday right before the evening, they would say that's not allowed. I think a modern day example is maybe like having a washing machine running on Shabbat. But anyway, so one verse where they get it from is this, where it says on 6 days, no work shall be done. But then it says on the seventh day, you shouldn't do any work, in the active tense again. So this particular verse that I've brought leaves some suspicion that, well, maybe the intent of the text isn't to prohibit the passive verse. So in this particular verse, we have 6 days, no work shall be done. On the seventh day, you won't do work. So passive on the 6 days, active on the seventh. But we have another verse in Exodus 12, where it basically says, on Shabbat, no work shall be done. So there it more explicitly prohibits any passive work on the Sabbath.
Just clarify with an example, once again, passive and active work.
Definitely. So active work is work that I am doing and I am focusing on. If I'm writing a paper, that's active work, mm-hmm. right? Because I'm sitting at my computer, typing it up, thinking about it, etc. There's also work that I can leave running. So if I go downstairs, put my stuff in the washing machine and let it run, then I've started a process of work, but I'm not active in doing it.
Okay, but it's passively ticking over when Shabbat comes if your washing machine is still... okay, I'm with you. Yeah.
Yes. And so the rabbinic sages said that type of work, or, well, the normative rabbinic opinion today is that that type of work is permitted on Shabbat, passive work, or passive tasks. But the Karaite opinion is that passive work isn't permitted on Shabbat.
Okay, now just before we get back onto fire and while we're still talking about work, just to clarify, you distinguish between the rabbinic interpretation of work and the Karaite interpretation of work. The rabbinic interpretation of work, and correct me if I'm wrong, is derived primarily from a verse in Exodus chapter 31, verse 13. And from this verse, and the understanding of this verse, is derived the 39 prohibitions of Shabbat. Exodus chapter 31, verse 13, "Speak also to the children of Israel, saying, but my Sabbaths you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you." It is also interpreted as, "Surely my Sabbaths you shall keep," which gives it a different spin altogether. If it is "but," then it's saying conversely, and everything that follows, not follows, everything that precedes that verse is the work that is to put together the tabernacle and the furnishings thereof.
And what precedes that verse? Right, the work to, the work to make the tabernacle.
And from that, and interpreting this word as "but," therefore conversely, from that is derived the, by analyzing the work that took place to put the tabernacle together and the furnishings thereof, 39 prohibitions of Shabbat. Do the Karaites hold to this as well?
The short answer is no. The long answer is, for the most part, yes. But let me back up. So what the Karaites say is that the word menacha isn't defined as a list of 39 prohibitions. Okay, the in rabbinic law, menacha in the context of Shabbat means 39 prohibitions. Now, this works for them because they can say, look, the list of 39 is related to the Mishkan, but we know it needs to be related to the Mishkan, and we know it needs to be just this list of 39 as opposed to anything else because it was revealed in the Oral Torah. Naturally, the Karaites, can't say anything of the sort, that there's this list of 39, which doesn't appear explicitly anywhere in the Torah, but yet was revealed. So that doesn't work from a Karaite standpoint. But what they do say is that the word melacha has a much more natural, intuitive definition, which, as I've alluded to before, is just means task. It's basically something you do in order to accomplish a goal. And you can easily see how, that definition would have found usage even before the giving of the Torah, which mm-hmm. explains how an Israelite could have read this and said, oh, I understand now what's forbidden.
Right.
Now, there's one big issue with this interpretation that we haven't yet addressed. Basically, right, if we say any task that you do to accomplish a goal is forbidden, then what in the end is permitted? Right? Like, can I get dressed? Well, that's a task I do to accomplish something.
Well, the first thing I thought of when you said that initially, Tomer, was, can I go to the toilet?
There's okay.
Now I say this, but if you go to Qumran, they will show you a video that suggests that the Assyrians held to the idea that one was not allowed to go to the toilet on Shabbat.
Yeah, so definitely that doesn't fall within kind of the more pragmatic Karaite approach, but it's kind of exemplifying the same problem, which mm-hmm. is, if the general word melacha is very broad and it means any activity that accomplishes some goal I have, well, then what's allowed? And the answer that the Karaite sages give is basically, well, Shabbat is a holy day, so there's things, the things that are allowed are things which make the day holy. So, for example, sacrifices involve a lot of slaughtering, burning, etc. But we see that they're explicitly required on Shabbat, and that's because they accomplish the goal of making Shabbat holy.
Sure.
So similarly, prayer is allowed, walking is allowed to get to synagogue, eating and drinking to, you know, make the day happy is allowed. Also, by the way, because we see Moses when the Israelites first collect the manna from heaven, we see Moses telling them, collect it, whatever you collected yesterday on Friday, ichluhu hayom, eat it today on Saturday. So that's like biblical proof that you're allowed to eat on Shabbat. So generally the approach of the Karaite sages is like anything which is necessary, like walking, moving, going to the bathroom, eating, drinking, is permitted on Shabbat. Anything that makes the day holy is also permitted on Shabbat. And those are the two broad categories. Mm-hmm. And there's a verse, I think, that ties together the Shabbat theory really nicely and really shows you what melacha means. And that verse is actually in Yeshayahu, in Isaiah. And it's a fairly, I think, well-known verse when it comes to Shabbat. But the verse is, Im tashiv mi Shabbat raglecha asot chafetzecha beyom kodshi, which is like, if you refrain on Shabbat from doing your desires on my holy day, v'karata le-Shabbat oneg, and you call Shabbat delight, le-kadosh Adonai mechubad, to, likdosh Adonai mechubad, to sanctify God, the respected one, then he goes on to say basically that this is a good thing if you do this. Mm-hmm. If you refrain from your desires on my holy day and in order to sanctify me, that's what God says. So if you read this verse from the context of the rabbinic perspective, like melacha means 39 different actions, it's very bizarre because where is Isaiah getting this idea of not doing your desires on Shabbat, right? Where does that come from? Like, I know I'm not allowed to do a list of 39 things. I can't sew or bake, etc. But I didn't know I wasn't allowed to do my desires. Whereas this perfectly exemplifies the Karaite approach, this verse, because it's saying, don't do your desires. Don't accomplish any goals, basically, for your own ends. But, call Shabbat holy and make it holy and sanctify me through Shabbat. So then it seems clear why kind of the Karaite approach is to say, look, melacha is forbidden except for things that are consistent with the idea of Shabbat being a holy day, or from the pragmatic standpoint, from things which are necessary, walking, eating, etc.
Right. Ken?
Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
That does make sense. I had also heard, and feel free to correct me if I am wrong, but that other things are tied into this as well, because you would say that you are free to do things that bring sanctity to the Shabbat, but according to Karaite Halacha, playing an instrument might not be because of the actual action of playing the instrument, but that the instrument might require maintenance while playing, so that there is a form of fence system that's built into Karaite Halacha when it comes to the observance of the Shabbat and other things.
Yeah. I've never heard that particular interpretation, that there's kind of a fence to say, well, if you play the instrument, then it may require fixing. So it's not the playing, it's the fixing that's a problem, because the playing itself is to sanctify Shabbat, so that should be okay. The view more, I think, is that the Karaite sages, and here I think there's room for debate in terms of whether they were correct about this. I think generally in terms of the theory of Shabbat, they are correct, but they took a very conservative view on what's allowed. So they actually look at a different verse in the Torah that says, "Sheshet yamim ta'aseh ma'asecha uvayom ha'shvi'i tishbot." 6 days you shall do your actions, basically, and on the seventh day you shall stop. So there they go even further and they say, like, look, here it's not even saying tasks, it's saying actions. So basically and on top of that, we know Shabbat is an incredibly important commandment. So from that standpoint, they say, look, we're going to interpret work and tasks very stringently. So we're going to say, like, really only the essential holy things and, like, the essential necessary tasks are permitted. So something like playing an instrument, which isn't, which isn't, I guess they didn't see as essential to making Shabbat holy as prayer or study or spending time with family or, you know, that sort of stuff.
So you'd also say that in context, and I was saying this earlier, that one of the reasons why Karaites would be especially stringent for not letting fire burn throughout their habitations is because the verse right before that says, whoever makes work on it is to be put to death. And that would basically put the severity of the commandment in context.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, that, again, Shabbat is taken very seriously. So they're, you know, the sages weren't like trigger happy in terms of saying like, well, fire is forbidden, but really it's necessary. They prefer to permit things only if they're absolutely necessary. But one thing they do point to, by the way, since you mentioned context, is that, you know, that verse immediately before then uses the passive voice to refer to passive work. No work, no work shall be done during the 6 days. And then it goes into fire. So they say like, well, you know, in context, this is talking about fire being left to passively burn, not fire being lit. They don't think it's a coincidence that fire is mentioned after a passive prohibition as opposed to an active prohibition. They think it's intentional.
I'm glad you brought it up, though, Ken, because really what it's saying is, so you can interpret it this way, but you can also legitimately interpret this way, but you might die. So make your choice.
Right. Well, I mean...
And also... go.
I also don't think that the proper way to read the verses is like, if you get the wrong interpretation, you die. First of all, you know, I think there's a difference. The death penalty isn't given for doing melacha. It's given for doing something called lechalel Shabbat, which is to profane Shabbat
with a raised hand, as it is in Bamidbar.
What do you mean with a raised hand?
The man with who went collecting wood in Numbers, and it says, if I do recall, that he did so with a raised hand, with a raised fist, if you like, in defiance. In fact, I think it says it interprets in some translations as intentional or presumptuous sin. Toma.
Yeah, I mean, I won't speak to that specific case without looking at the verses more carefully, but in general, the law is that you need to basically do it intentionally. Mm-hmm. And I personally think it goes beyond intentionally, which isn't to say like, you know, I broke Shabbat and I intentionally, you know, cooked on Shabbat. You have to go further. I cooked with the intention of making Shabbat not holy.
Right.
And that's what the word means when it gives the penalty elsewhere.
So, in other words, if one sincerely understands this particular verse to say, no fire shall be burning on Shabbat, and then goes and starts a fire and cooks on that fire, intentionally, in their mind, breaking that commandment, then there is that's an example of what you're talking about, right?
Possibly, according to some sages, but I wouldn't even go that far. I think if you cook intentionally or you have a fire lit and then you cook on Shabbat, I still wouldn't say that's enough to require, you know, capital punishment. I think, let me back up and explain like what the, when it's, because elsewhere there's a verse that says, you know, anybody who profanes Shabbat. And the verse, the root of that word mechalel, profane, is to, chol is basically the opposite of holy. It's the, I don't know, what is it in English? It's like secular, but it's like mundane,
common.
Basically.
Common.
So if you make the Shabbat mundane, so I would say that like if somebody basically makes a blessing on Shabbat or goes to synagogue on Shabbat, even if they drive there or does anything in some way to observe Shabbat, like he's still not making it mundane because he still made it holy in some way, even though he hasn't quite made it holy, you know, fully without doing work.
But there's intention there. There's intention to set it apart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's intention to set it apart. And even if there's no intention to set it apart, but there's also no intention to explicitly not set it apart, make it mundane, then I'd say he's still okay with regards to capital punishment. It's only, as you said, rebelliously, if you actively say, I'm going to go and take this thing which is holy and I'm going to, you know, desecrate it and make it mundane. And again, even then, the capital punishment would only apply in a situation where you have courts and prophets and...
Sure, of course, you know, of
the
course.
The divine whatever is more that manifest than it is today and more obviously correct.
Sure.
So also a question on going a little bit backwards to direct and indirect, active and passive melecha. I know that something where also Karaites and rabbinic Jews differ in their interpretation is also the use of electricity on Shabbat. Mm-hmm. And both of them, correct me if I'm wrong, see it as a flow that is turned on and off, but that rabbinic Jews see it as completing a circuit. But the problem that Karaites would have with it is that it's receiving from a source of which is not ending, as opposed to unless it was like battery powered or something like that. I had read something about Israeli Karaites in their use of electricity and how it might differ from their rabbinic counterparts. And I don't know if you had anything to put on that.
Yeah, definitely. So let me address that. So the first thing to know, just in terms of context, is that electricity is relatively new. So generally speaking, the classical sages don't speak about anything resembling electricity. There's one exception from Chacham Levi ben Yefet, who lived in the year 1000, which is interesting. But maybe we can get to that later. So electricity necessarily needs to be addressed by, you know, sages or Karaites who lived in the past like 200 years or so. And that unfortunately means that the level of scholarship on this topic and the is, you know, less than it would have been when Karaite Judaism was in its prime, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard for me to say, you know, like, what's the classical Karaite opinion on electricity on Shabbat? Certainly some people see the main problem with it as being, you know, there's people working in the power plant and you're using their electricity, or you're paying for the electricity via your meter thing, like on your house or something like that. Mm. And I do think all of those are problems and things to consider. But even then, there's Karaites who will say, like, battery-powered electricity is basically like fire, like electricity is sparks, which lights fire, so it's the same thing. And I don't think that opinion is particularly well thought out. But, there's in practice, there's generally a view that electricity, to actively use it on Shabbat, isn't allowed. Now, I'll tell you my opinion on it. My view is that there is no special status of electricity in Karaite Halacha. As we said, melacha basically means a task. And if the task you accomplish is not with regards to making Shabbat holy, then it's, you know, then it's not allowed. Mm-hmm. But theoretically, if you had something electronic which accomplished a task permitted on Shabbat and was disconnected from the grid and, you know, from any type of metered usage for paying stuff, and was the only way to accomplish that task, right? Remembering that generally the sages were minimalist in terms of, let alone tasks, just what you're allowed to do on Shabbat. They said, like, we're going to interpret this very conservatively. Then I think it'd be allowed. So an example, which is maybe a boring one, is to say, if you have an electronic door on Shabbat, mm-hmm. let's say for the sake of argument that it's battery powered, then, you know, there's nothing wrong with going through a door on Shabbat. So the fact that it's being run by electricity, in my opinion, is completely fine. The end result, the goal, is permitted. So in this case, the means by which you achieve it are also not problematic.
So would the electricity be viewed more as turning on, and if it was keeping the goal in mind, would it be better compared to turning on and off a faucet? Like flipping a switch would be similar to turning on and on a faucet, because no one really sees turning on a faucet and letting water into your house as a violation of Shabbat. I mean, even the most rigorous rabbinic, like Haredim, will turn on the faucet on Shabbat, even though they're paying for the water that comes in, even though they won't flip a light switch. I guess maybe the a Karaite opinion might be that, hey, electricity is flowing just like water. and you're paying for it just like an electric bill or a water bill. So those might be similar.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to like address the paying aspect per se. Like, I do think that theoretically, in terms of the most like nitty gritty aspects of the law, paying for it is generally speaking a problem. So I don't want to get into the paying aspect of it per se, but I do want to address what you're saying about flowing and kind of the physical process of electricity. And you mentioned before building a circuit. All this type of thinking of like what is electricity physically doing, or like what is the nature of electricity, I think that's irrelevant to Karaite law. I think it's relevant in rabbinic law because they give electricity a special status vis-a-vis Shabbat. But in Karaite law, I don't think that electricity, you know, it's nowhere in the Tanakh. I don't think electricity itself has a special status. I think it's what you use it for that counts. And this is more my opinion. I think that, you know, generally speaking, Karaites would say, no, electricity is not really allowed. But also, they generally speaking, they wouldn't get into like the nitty-gritty of why it's forbidden. I agree with them that on the whole, anything you use electricity for is going to be prohibited.
Because it is a new phenomena, and it has to be approached with special status, if you like. If we go all the way back to the time of inheritance of the land and breaking it up into the tribes, I have to think to myself that Menasheh, when it was allotted to them the high lands of northern Israel, you'd be thinking to yourself, well, that's great, but man, my Shabbats are going to be miserable. I mean, it snows there pretty significantly. What is the rational approach when considering something like that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, it's interesting. I don't know of any statements on the sages specifically addressing extreme cold, but I would say, like, if it's a matter of keeping yourself warm, then I'd say fire would be permitted. And again, you can take like a minimalist approach. So you can say, you know, light the fire before, or today use heat that doesn't use fire. But like if it's absolutely necessary, then for sure, like saving a life or not even risking a life always takes precedence.
And as you mentioned before, to make the day happy, I mean, in relation to food, of course, we understand we're allowed to eat and drink and we're supposed to rest on Shabbat. Shabbat's supposed to be a happy day. It's supposed to be a relaxing day, right? A day in the snow without fire back in the day is far from relaxing, right?
Right. But that being said, I wouldn't go so far as to say, like, well, you need light during nighttime hours to be happy, or you need warm food to be happy. The Torah still does prohibit fire. So like, and in the view of the Karaite sages, it was to leave fire burning. So that we shouldn't like interpret that so that it becomes meaningless, but we should interpret it within the context of, you know, what is actually feasible and what is risky for people not to do. This actually reminds me, if you don't mind, there is, so as kind of alluded to before, Bashiatzi was kind of, Chacham Bashiatzi was the first sage to sort of permit fire from the Karaite standpoint. Mm-hmm. That's how it's often seen. But actually, if you read Chacham Levi Ben Yefet, who I've mentioned before, and he lived 400 years, more than that, really 500 years before Bashiatzi, at the, you know, the year 1000 about is when he was active. And he mentions that there are some Karaites who said that they would allow fire in the synagogue. And the reason that they gave was that the verse says you can't have fire b'chol moshevotechem, in all your settlements. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it would be permitted in the temple and so too the synagogue. Because it's moshevotechem, it's your settlements. It's not really your dwellings. It's like a public communal religious building. Mm-hmm. And B... I'm not sure he says this, but I assume it's very consistent with the Karaite idea that, you know, the synagogue is for a holy purpose. So there you're allowed to have light. And I find this interpretation fascinating for two reasons. One, it shows that even Karaites before Bashiatzi, certainly not like he does, but in certain situations, at least some Karaites permitted fire. And two, it's just been really interesting to me to imagine a situation where you have the entire neighborhood be dark after a certain hour, but there's light in, you know, there's light in the synagogue, mm-hmm. which is kind of nice, I guess. only in the communal space is there going to be light, which is, part of Shabbat is creating time for other people, where people can get together away from their daily tasks and, form a holy Jewish community, etc.
Another interpretation that I have heard takes into consideration not the textual context, but the cultural context. That is to say that it wasn't easy back in the day necessarily to start a fire from scratch, okay, whether it be rubbing two sticks together or using flintstone or whatever it might be. It is somewhat of an art and certainly an effort. Could it be that the verse may pertain to the work of making fire, the work of kindling a fire from scratch? And therefore, today, as you mentioned, electricity is a new phenomenon. This is a technology that is relatively new, does away with that effort, and therefore we now have an easy flick of a switch by which we can warm ourselves and so on and so forth. Is that a permissible interpretation? Have you heard that before?
I've definitely heard it before. I don't think it has much merit, and I'll tell you why. The reason why is that it's basically very reliant on an English translation of the Hebrew verses. So melacha, even I've used it today and translated it as work. But as I've said, the more correct translation is kind of any goal you accomplish. And it's not, it's not necessarily about that goal being strenuous. It's about that goal not being related to the goals of Shabbat, the holy kind of nature of Shabbat. And in that context, it doesn't matter how easy or hard it is to light a fire, so long as the fire is accomplishing, some task which
right.
is not for the...
Let's go back to Exodus chapter 16. And Moses tells the Israelites, listen, go and collect. On Friday, collect twice as much. It's not going to go off. Prepare yourselves for Shabbat because there won't be any for you to collect on Shabbat. So collect twice as much. This is institution of a preparation day, if you like. In the same way, should we not be prepared in all ways? Therefore, having cannot electricity or an easy means of ignition be seen as a preparation?
To have it, because it's basically prepared beforehand.
Well, because it's something that you have on hand before Shabbat, by which you can instantly create warmth or whatever it may be that you need for the day without having to go through all the effort of on Shabbat of creating a fire. Can it be viewed
that way?
Yeah, but then
if you interpret the prohibition on fire of just being to light a fire, but as I've mentioned, the Karaite sages generally agreed that it was even to leave a fire burning on Shabbat they saw as being problematic. And as you mentioned, this is mentioned in Josephus, for example, as being a Second Temple opinion. This is not an opinion that began with the Karaite sages. It's always been a reading of this verse. So in that school of thought, it doesn't even matter how prepared the fire is. It's so long as the fire is running and accomplishing a task on Shabbat, it's not allowed. Because you haven't accomplished the task before Shabbat. You've set it up as much as possible before Shabbat.
Okay.
That being said, it's definitely an interesting argument. I haven't heard that one. So.
It is interesting. There's various ways of interpreting that verse. Can you think of any others?
I heard an interesting one. And I don't think I believe this. So generally, the word bo'er or the root in Hebrew, there's roots to words, and the root has some type of base meaning, and then it's depending on how you conjugate it, it can mean different things. So I'll give an example. Lechol means to eat. That's the root achal. Mm-hmm. But leha'achil means to feed. So it usually means related things. Why do I say this? Because the root of the word to burn is bo'er or ba'ag, which sometimes means to burn. So hasne bo'er is the burning bush. Mm-hmm. Tiva'agu here in this verse, in the verse you shall kindle no fire, presumably means kindle or have fire burn or something along those lines related to fire. Now, I heard once, and I forget where, but I heard once the view that it actually means lo tevago u'esh, doesn't mean light, it doesn't mean kindle, it actually means extinguish. Don't extinguish a fire on the Sabbath. And where do they get this from? We see elsewhere in the Torah, basically, when it says to either punish someone for their sins or like basically to avoid some type of wrongdoing, it says that by doing so, uviakta hara mikirbecha, you will burn away the badness from within your community or whatever. So burn away here is basically like utterly remove, utterly destroy. So they were reading the verse as you shouldn't, you know, utterly destroy the fire. You shouldn't turn off the fire because it's the same root as biakta, which means to completely do away with, which is also the same root as to burn.
I think that word in English a lot of the time is snuff out.
Right.
Yeah. That's what I've seen.
Now, okay. Now, if that is a legitimate reading, a permissible reading of the text, what would that mean in the greater context, taking into consideration the previous verse?
Yeah, I mean, if you want, I mean, first of all, this reading I thought was creative, but I don't really buy it because, generally speaking, the root ba'ag refers to something related to fire. In some contexts, maybe we see it metaphorically referring to doing away with evil, like utterly doing away with it, utterly burning it away. Mm-hmm. But in this case, we're talking about fire.
Hmm.
And I think it could have, you know, it would have said turn it off in a different way. But, you know, what it would mean if it were correct was basically that you can't extinguish a flame on Shabbat. And this was indeed the view of the rabbinic sages. The earlier Karaite sages said you should extinguish a flame if you see it running on Shabbat. But then the later ones said you shouldn't have one running. But if the flame is burning on Shabbat and you find out, oh, darn, this is burning, don't then extinguish it, because then you're like actively doing a task to extinguish it.
Hmm. That's a relief to everyone who has a gas hot water system and a pilot light.
Well, yeah, in a way. I mean, according to the most stringent, I'm not telling everybody to, you know, go and turn off their pilot lights immediately. or do anything immediately. Generally, I think it's good to get used to religious opinions and think about them before implementing them. But, I mean, strictly speaking, even the Karaite sages who said don't turn it off on Shabbat would say, yeah, but turn it off before Shabbat.
My goodness. We have, I think, covered pretty much every angle. Is there anything else, Ken, that you wanted to add to the conversation?
I think that, like, if you would have kept us rambling, we probably could have gone into electricity for a long time, but it wouldn't have gotten anywhere. So I think it's good that stopped where it did.
Okay. Tomer, is there anything you'd like to add to the conversation before we sign off?
Yeah, I think I'll add an interesting tidbit now that Ken has mentioned electricity. So this Chacham Levi, who, again, year 1000 that I mentioned before, has a very interesting passage in his work, right? Normally, I wouldn't expect to find any type of precedent about electricity in ancient works, you know, like it wouldn't make any sense. But he does talk about people using rocks for light on Shabbat. And he does ask, like, is this permitted or forbidden?
As in flint, for example? Is this what you're saying?
I don't think he means flint, because flint, you know, you hit the rock and then you light a fire like that.
Okay.
I think he means like the rocks somehow give off light. So I could think of two possible things of what he's talking about. One is that he's talking about like uranium or something, which would give off a green.
Look at this! Look at this rock that I found outside. Let's put it inside. Right, it's making everything bright.
On Shabbat.
Even I'm glowing.
I feel tingly inside.
Yeah. I feel warm and fuzzy.
So there, I would advise people not to use it on Shabbat for other reasons.
Thus saith Tomer, do not use uranium to light on Shabbat.
But another possibility is, I was wondering if it was maybe some type of crystal. Because like when you have a chandelier, for example, the reason you have all those glass things is so that the light refracts and kind of gets spread out all over the place. So I was thinking maybe it's referring to like if you have the sunlight coming in from the window, you put this thing. He mentions like putting it on the table or something. So like you put this rock on the table.
And it distributes then the light into the room. Right, beautiful.
So, you know, what's the deeper message of this? Pretty much nothing. I just wanted to share an interesting tidbit.
That is,
but
so is it like a Shabbat disco ball, basically?
Yeah, I think it would probably look kind of like a Shabbat disco
like
ball.
Can you reflect light on Shabbat would be the question.
Yeah, and he does say he basically says that he thinks it's permitted. And then he adds, which means, and it's good to be careful. So whatever this rock was, he was like a little suspicious of it, which, you know, maybe means it wasn't just a crystal reflecting window light. Maybe it was uranium. I don't know. Maybe we need a historian who would have a better idea as to what this was. But
some kind of magic amulet.
It's really curious, yeah.
Yeah, but my point is, like, you find out a lot of interesting things about how people lived and what type of technology they had and what creative solutions they came up with by reading these texts. Mm. And you also, I think it gives you an appreciation for the level of detail that the Karaite sages went into in terms of determining like specific cases and the nitty-gritty of the law.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you, gentlemen. Ken Lane of OkiHebrew.com, Toma Mangubi of a contributor to the book Levush Malkut, which we opened with in this recording, Royal Attire by Hakam Mordechai Ben Nissan, vocalized, translated, and annotated by Gabriel Wasserman, available through thekaraitepress.com. Is this, now, last time we spoke, there was this book was available, and I highly recommend everybody get this book. It was available bundled with James Walker's commentary on Esther. Do you know if that's still available, Ken?
Yes, right now, and it was before, well, it's called the Press Pass, and if you go to thekaraitepress.com and you go to the full catalog, or if you, it's technically thekaraitepress.com/collections/all, but then you can actually get those two books together for $32, which is Royal Attire and Esther Explained.
That's great.
And
ordinarily, I would highly recommend both of them too. I think Esther Explained is usually $17. Royal Attire is $25. So this is excellent value for money. Again, I will put a link to that bundle so that people can take advantage of that. I'll put it under this post. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming back on to Truth to You.
Yeah, it was a blast.
You've been listening to Truth to You with me, Jono Vandoor. Join me on the coming Truth to You Israel tour. Details at our website, truthtoyou.org. That's truth2letteryou.org. Thank you for your company, and I hope you'll join us again. Until next time, shalom.